Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Jim Garrity of National Review is back. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We trust you had a wonderful Easter weekend. We come back to you with good, bad, and crazy martinis. And, Jim, we start with the good. And we go to Meet the Press with Chuck Todd. His guest was Homeland Security Secretary, retired General John Kelly. And the issue was dealing with illegal immigration. And Jim, after 8 years of the Obama administration, and even to some extent the attitude of the Bush administration, Kelly's straightforward approach here really is pretty refreshing. A couple of different clips here, three to be precise. Let's start with Chuck Todd questioning General Kelly about whether they should really be spending the border wall money on internal enforcement.
Would the money for the border wall be better spent on going after the visa overstays? And would that actually deal with the problem President Trump campaigned on?
You really do have to secure the border somehow, first and foremost. Mm-hmm. The very, very, very good news is, for a lot of different reasons, the number of illegal aliens that are moving up from the south has dropped off precipitously. I mean, we're down 65-70% in the last 2 months. These are the months that we should see a steep incline mm-hmm. in illegal movement.
And then Kelly made the point that while a lot of people are wringing their hands about the number of deportations, he says right now they're just focusing on criminals, although he did tell Chuck Todd there's a difference between how this administration approaches criminality as opposed to the last one.
Just because you're in the United States illegally doesn't necessarily get you targeted. It's got to be something else. And we're operating more or less at the other end of the spectrum, and that is criminals, multiple convictions.
But define a criminal here, because that's where there's been, so it seemed as if in the Obama administration there was one definition. There seems to be another definition in this administration. Right. Is that fair to say?
It is fair to say that the definition of criminal has not changed, but where on the spectrum of criminality we operate has changed.
So can you give me an example of somebody that wasn't deported before that you're deporting now?
Well, someone, as an example, with multiple DUIs, even a single DUI, depending on other aspects, mm-hmm. Would get you into the system. And remember, for the most...
And this wouldn't have been the case under the
unlikely.
Previous administration.
And finally, he said this.
There's a system, a legal justice system in place, and the law deports people. Secretary Kelly doesn't, ICE doesn't. It's the United States, criminal justice system, a justice system that deports people.
Jim, after 8 years plus of tortured verbal gymnastics, it's nice to just listen to someone say, this is what the law says and we're enforcing it.
Yeah, I was very intrigued by the mentioning of DUIs there, Greg. Way back when President George W. Bush was addressing immigration in his second term, this was back in, I'm going to say, late 2007, and George W. Bush and the administration indicated they were opening to doing a version of what we now call comprehensive immigration reform, which many conservatives interpreted as amnesty. This is one of the Senate gang efforts. I don't know if it was the Gang of Eight, Gang of 12. It was a gang of senators of both parties getting together and saying, well, look, you want to create a path to citizenship. We want to create a path to citizenship. There are only these crazy, right-wingers out in the heartland who seem to object to this. Let's put all this together. Let's take the 11 million people who are here illegally and make them legal, because this won't come back and bite us in the tush in any way, shape, or form. And obviously many folks objected to this, but one of the provisions was, there were two couple provisions there that rightfully outraged people. Among them, I don't know if you recall this, Greg, the idea that illegal immigrants were going to have to pay back taxes on three of the past 5 years. Now, the first thing is the idea that, I'm sure a lot of these people are getting paid under the table. So there aren't really good records of how much money they've made over the past three years, five years, or even just the past year. There's no way to say, I made this much, I have to pay this much in back taxes. But the second thing, so 3 out of 5 years, it's good to note this on tax day, Greg. So have you paid taxes in 3 of the past 5 years?
Yeah, 5 out of 5, actually.
I was going to say, do we have the option of not paying 2 of the past 5 years? So this special privilege you're going to give to people who have entered the country illegally, and the advocates of the law are like, no, we're totally enforcing the law. Well, if you're letting people not pay taxes for a few years, then no, you're not enforcing the law. But we mentioned about DUIs. There was this big argument about everyone agreed, okay, we're going to deport the worst criminals. And the question was whether a DUI or multiple DUIs counted as a serious crime. And there was a very strong push, I believe, from the Democrats, but I'd have to go back and look. But there were certainly advocates of the deal wanted to minimize the consequence of a DUI. And now I'm one of those folks who's perfectly comfortable with this. Cheryl Atkinson did a report last week. I believe it was out in Portland, Oregon, about a local guy. He's an illegal immigrant. He runs a food truck. He's very active in his church and his communities, and everybody loves him, but he committed a DUI. Now, every DUI is a vehicular manslaughter or vehicular homicide that got lucky, right? If you're driving behind the wheel and you are drunk, you're at risk of hitting someone or killing yourself. The idea that, well, you broke the law coming into the country illegally, and then you broke the law by getting behind the wheel of a car and driving around inebriated, we're still going to cut you some slack. At some point, you start wondering, wait, why are all the laws applying to me, the good citizen, and not applying to this guy who entered the country illegally? So I'm glad to see this. I'm sorry. I think if you've committed a DUI, yes, you should be deported. I think if there's any argument about any form of amnesty, any form of a path to citizenship, a path to legal status, a path to a work permit or things like that, you have to keep your nose clean. You have to avoid committing additional crimes here. So I just don't recognize this idea that this enforcement policy of deporting people who've committed DUIs represents some draconian or authoritarian step in U.S. Immigration policy. It just strikes me as common sense, and it's good to see the administration not just enacting this policy, but being, you know, willing to take the slings of arrows and criticism to say, no, this is the right policy. And everybody else who's on the other side of this deep down is saying that drunk drivers should be allowed to stay in the country illegally.
On to the bad martini now, and this is courtesy of Eli Lake over at Bloomberg. Jim, it was just over the weekend here that the National Security Advisor, H.R. McMaster, General McMaster, was talking about North Korea, and he said he believed every diplomatic tool in the toolbox ought to be on the table when it comes to North Korea, short of military action, which makes this report from Eli Lake a little bit puzzling. Senior White House and administration officials tell me that Trump's national security advisor, General H.R. McMaster, has been quietly pressing his colleagues to question the underlying assumptions of a draft war plan against the Islamic State that would maintain only a light U.S. ground troop presence in Syria. McMaster's critics inside the administration say he wants to send tens of thousands of ground troops to the Euphrates River Valley. His supporters insist he is only trying to facilitate a better interagency process to develop Trump's new strategy to defeat the self-described caliphate that controls territory in Iraq and Syria. Further down, it points out that this idea is not at all welcomed by the likes of General Mattis or Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Dunford or even General Vogel, who's in charge of U.S. Central Command. White House senior strategist Stephen Bannon has derided McMaster to his colleagues as trying to start a new Iraq war, according to the sources for Eli Lake. So, Jim, there's a lot of reasons why that idea is certainly not going to be welcome after all we've been through for the last 15 years or so. But the idea that this president, who specifically campaigned against big ground troop missions and called the Iraq war a major disaster in debate after debate, would be even entertaining such a thing.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it's very nice to hear people saying every option is on the table. Because you never want to say to Assad or ISIS or anybody over there, don't worry, we're not going to do X.
Right.
Having said that, there are certain options that are on the table, but we really don't want – we want them on the table, but on the edge of the table. So if the table wobbles at all, it falls off the table, and suddenly it's not on the table anymore. Because I think it's safe to say there are not many Americans who – there's probably no Americans who are downright enthusiastic about the idea of sending tens of thousands of troops into Syria. We already have troops over Syria. It's easy to forget that. During the Obama administration, there was kind of this attitude of like, look, we're going to fight a war, but don't tell anyone. And you can see increasing numbers of troops being dispatched back to Iraq. Look, we ended two wars and then kept sending troops there, as Obama would proudly announce. I do think if you're on the one hand, yes, the President Trump or on the campaign trail, Trump used to say, oh, why are we talking about this stuff? Why are we announcing what we're going to do before we're going to do it? We need to hit surprise. Certainly the airstrikes or the missile strikes of last Thursday seemed to come out of the blue and achieved a certain amount of tactical surprise on the Syrians. And so we kind of say, well done. On the other hand, deep down, we kind of do need to discuss these things before we're going to make these kind of large-scale military commitments. We think back to the discussion of the authorization of military force before Afghanistan, the vote for the before the Iraq War, the vote for authorizing military force before the Persian Gulf War. Now, it's not to say that the presidents are always good about this. Obama never went to Congress for authorization of force on any of these. And I believe the entire military option in the Balkans back during Bill Clinton's term was not, never got any type of congressional authorization. This is a balance. I think it's safe to say the American people deserve a chance to weigh in here and deserve to have to let their lawmakers hear it. And I'm not comfortable, and I think a lot of Americans would not be comfortable with the idea of committing tens of thousands of U.S. ground troops to a military conflict, no matter how worthy, no matter how justified, without a vote in Congress. This is how the system is supposed to work. The War Powers Act is supposed to give presidents very limited emergency powers to deal with crises. And I think it's safe to say that as bad as Syria is, it's not reached a point where we need to send in tens of thousands of U.S. troops. So I'm not willing to buy into this idea that McMaster is a crazed warmonger or there's anything wrong with him for discussing this option. I think we got to look at everything seriously. But I can't really believe that this has to be – if this is being considered very seriously, then it has to be a public debate, even if we lose a little bit of the element of surprise. By the way, in light of what we discussed in the Good Martini about enforcement of immigration, how there are much fewer people who are attempting to cross the border now that they know the U.S. government is taking this seriously, Greg, have we heard about any chemical weapons attacks since last Thursday or since the U.S. missile strikes? We're at a good 10 days or so. Of no chemical weapons use, maybe they got the message, right? Maybe there's some use to having the idea of U.S. discussing, well, look, Assad, ISIS, we don't want to come over there and send in tens of thousands of troops, but we'll do it if we have to. Maybe that'll put, probably not ISIS, but maybe the Assad regime will be on slightly better behavior if they hear a little bit of saber rattling. So I suppose I could see some value to that, but the idea of getting into another large Middle East invasion and war can't be optimistic news for anybody.
No, there's very little American appetite for that, I would say. Let's move on to the crazy martini now and over to Heat Street, which is talking about the Huffington Post. Huffington Post recently pulled down a piece that was obviously designed to be inflammatory last week, and we'll get into why they pulled it in just a moment. But here's what they write over at Heat Street. The Huffington Post's recent publication of a blog post proposing the stripping of white men of their right to vote sparked widespread anger across social media. The editors initially defended the piece, titled, quote, "Could it be time to deny white men the franchise?" They even crowed about how much traffic it was getting and mocked readers for complaining, before suddenly reversing their decision and deleting the post over the weekend. It was argued that if white men no longer had the vote, the progressive cause would be strengthened. It would not be necessary to deny white men indefinitely. The denial of the vote to white men for 20 years, just less than a generation, would go some way to seeing a decline in the influence of reactionary and neoliberal ideology in the world. The author blamed white men for Brexit and the election of Donald Trump. Huffington Post South African editors were initially pleased with the reception of this article by someone named Shelley Garland. On Saturday night, the Huff Post South Africa editor bragged that the article had received plenty of traffic while making a tongue-in-cheek complaint about his corrections box. Then, following the extensive backlash, Huffington Post deleted the article, replacing it with a meek apology and a claim that they were unable to confirm that the author, Shelley Garland, was a real person. They even had to hilariously clarify that they are in favor of universal voting enfranchisement. So, Jim, what's the crazier aspect here? They didn't even vet that the person exists. Obviously, somebody wrote it. Or the fact that they found this topic interesting and valid enough to even go with it.
I actually would really like to, because, oh, this is it's Jonathan Swift, a modest proposal. It's satire. It's meant to make you laugh. It's meant to make you think. So I'd be curious about what... Like, is the idea that denying people the vote based on race and gender is wrong? Because if so, is there anybody, actually, a show of hands amongst all of our listeners, does anybody disagree with that? Does anybody actually advocate the elimination of voting rights based on race or gender? Okay, if you are raising your hand, go away. You're a bad person. But my guess is most people, it's very hard to find somebody who actually says, yeah, I don't actually believe that African Americans should be allowed to vote. Or you're not going to hear a lot of people. You hear maybe a little bit of tongue-in-cheek joking, but I don't think anybody actually says, yeah, it's time to rescind the constitutional amendment that gave the right to vote to women. We need to get rid of that. The world would be better if women didn't have the vote. If they do, those guys are probably sleeping on the couch or unable to get girlfriends in the first place. There's a lot of bitterness when you start seeing comments like that. So I don't quite get what they're attempting to mock here. I don't quite get what they're attempting to ridicule. And the idea that, you know, because I don't think there's that many people. The only person who's genuinely calling for people to be denied the right to vote based on the color of their skin or their gender are this lunatic at the Huffington Post. You have become exactly what you claim to stand against, Huffington Post. If they reversed it, you'd be the first who'd be tearing your hair out in great, you know, great storms of outrage. Now you laugh at the outrage of the other side. I guess the idea is that, well, you're not really supposed to be that bothered by the idea of people being denied the vote based on race and gender. Except we are, right? I thought it was something we had broad cultural agreement on. Apparently we don't. Apparently the problem is only certain people are allowed to have their rights denied or something. So again, in the effort to fight racism, the Huffington Post pretty much is embracing racism. In the effort to fight sexism, they are embracing sexism. And it's, rather revealing of that. Also kind of basic, make sure you know who exists, or who, if they're using a pen name, it's probably good to say so. Otherwise you're just, you know, I guess you and I could probably pretty easily get something, published at Huffington Post, right? Right, Greg? All we have to do is just make up something that sounds kind of crazy, you know, and some variation of conservatives are stupid or, white men are stupid or something like that. And, you know, they'll run it. I think it's pretty clear, you know, they've defined their brand pretty clearly with this, I'd suggest, Greg.
Yeah. Well, white men are clearly, when you look at voting patterns, the most conservative demographic at the ballot box. So if we just got rid of them, Jim, I'm sure everything would be progressive and then everything would be lovely and we'd all be singing together like in the Coke commercial, not in the Pepsi commercial, but in the Coke commercial from back in the 70s. I'd like to teach the world to sing. But somewhere I feel there's some editor at Slate pounding the table going, why didn't we think of that first?
Exactly. Dang it. They beat us.
Oh, Jim, I hope you had a lovely vacation because the craziness hasn't stopped and we'll be dealing with it going forward. So welcome back. It's good to have you.
Good to be back. And yeah, a whole lot changed while I was gone, Greg.
Yes, it certainly did.
World got saved.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Tuesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.